On today's episode of Dance Med Spotlight, I have the pleasure of chatting with Dr. Emily Sherb. She is the circus doc. She's a physical therapist, educator, author, researcher, so many things, who is truly the specialist in the area of circus arts. Now, when you hear that term circus, you may have a preconceived notion of what that means. And as a performer, you may be saying, oh, that's not me. This is not my episode. That is not the case. So circus, and we talk about this in this episode, encompasses so many things that we do see in other forms of performing arts, dance, and people wanting to get into other ways of moving their bodies and being healthy. So more people are going to identify with things that we talk about in this episode than may even realize it, as well as the providers who treat these folks. So make sure that you check out this episode. There's a ton of really great information, and Emily shares with us some important resources, both for people getting into some of these circus disciplines and apparati, and people who want to learn more about it from the clinician side. So check this episode out. Welcome back to another episode of Dance Med Spotlight, where we talk about all things dance medicine and dance science. Today, I am super excited for my guest, Dr. Emily Sherb. Welcome. Emily is a physical therapist, owner of The Circus Doc, an educator, author, researcher, doing all the fun things that we're able to do, which I absolutely love. And I'm really excited to talk more about the circus aspect of all of these things.
I am so excited for to be here, Alyssa. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So first of all, first question that I always ask everybody is give sort of the short story version of what got you to this point of wanting to make this your specialty and working with this particular population.
Okay, the short version. The very short version is I was a gymnast growing up until I found circus. I was very happy to trade this similar training mentality of hard work, pushing yourself, challenging with new skills for a clapping, cheering environment versus a scoring environment. You know, you don't have that same stress going out there and being like, I'm going to put it on the line and achieve my best versus I'm going to show everyone what I can do and share this moment with them. It's a really different, I'm sure all the performers out there kind of understand, like there's a really different feeling when you're sharing your performance versus competing. So I found circus myself first, and I went to PT school and loved that, loved learning more about how the body moves, taking my knowledge of movement from being a movement educator in circus, being a mover myself, and then being like, oh, this gives me the superpower as a PT too. This is kind of cool. And then I was always like, oh, I will work in the field. I will see a couple circus patients. Little did I know that this is going to be my entire career. So I have been thrilled to hit the timing right, come out of school just as circus was becoming more popular. I went from having, you know, a couple circus patients to, once they realized that there was somebody there to help them, my entire practice is now circus. So that's the really short version. And then from there, once I had an entire practice of circus, I realized how little care and how little knowledge is around this community. And that kind of led to everything else that I do.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think particularly in the last few years, I've seen a big uptick of, you know, whether it's people even pursuing like aerial yoga and things like that, where there's that lovely crossover, or seeing more aerial and circus type performers on shows like America's Got Talent, you know, all kinds of different things where it definitely is popping up more. And then even in kind of traditional dance studios, places that are now offering aerial classes or at least incorporating a lot more like acrobatic aerial type stuff for their dancers as well.
Absolutely. Incorporated into dance studios, into yoga studios, the acro push in the dance competition world, if you look at Broadway and the new shows coming out or the new or touring musical acts, the amount of circus that's been incorporated into kind of every aspect of the performing arts world, it's massively exploding and kind of growing exponentially.
Yeah. For people who maybe aren't familiar of like what exactly we're talking about when we talk about circus, what are some of the sort of subcategories that might go under there to help familiarize people a little bit?
Yeah, it's really funny because when you say circus, kind of people have this preconceived notion generally of like a big tent and sparkles and sequins. And circus really is, as we're talking about, so much more than that. There can be a really small, intimate, story-driven performing arts piece like you would see kind of in coming out of like the modern dance world, or you could have that showy piece that's kind of, you know, all about the sparkles and showing that off and about the tricks and the skills versus the storyline. But the thing about circus that makes it really different than many of the other performing arts forms is that it's so broad. So circus is everything from an artist that walks into my clinic that is a five ball juggler. We're a two-ball juggler, you know, a juggler. It can be an aerialist. That's probably the one that's most common and is growing the fastest across the U.S. And across the world, but certainly here in the U.S. is aerial. And we've got all different apparatus. We've got things that you hang from that are hanging straight down from the ceiling, things that are bar apparatus that you grab onto, different ways of strapping the body in and hanging and moving through space. It can be something that is kind of taking it to a whole nother topic before we come back, but there can be social circus or therapeutic based circus. So we can use circus as a therapeutic tool. There's tumbling, there's trampoline, there's partner acrobatics. That's also a really popular one. Everything from acro yoga, kind of using yoga movements in acrobatics and balancing partners, to standing acrobatics, to throwing and pitching and catching bodies moving through space. It can be done in partners or groups. It can be done solo. There is just such a huge array of what circus means, and therefore the understanding of what circus means as a clinician is also really fun because, hey, you know, this circus artist could actually be a musician and they're playing music for a show that is touring that's circus. And, you know, they're right now, they're part of the circus, even though they probably wouldn't classify themselves as a circus artist. But if you're the athletic trainer, the PT, the clinician that's on that tour, on a circus tour, you're dealing with musicians too. So the thing about circus is it's so big and broad. There's, you know, even as we see this surge of popularity of pole dancing and recreational pole dancing and competitive pole dancing, depending on who you talk to, people will consider that in the circus realm as well. So really, it's like, do you perform on a stage? Do you classify yourself as circus? And by stage, I mean, do you perform? Do you classify yourself as circus? You're a circus. You could be kicking around a hacky sack, and that could be considered a juggling tool and circus. So there's such a big, broad range of what it is versus a limited range of what we perceive it to be. And the other thing that's really cool on circus that I touched on, because I could just talk about this forever, is that it's really, you can approach it at any level. Because it's circus and it doesn't have this strictly codified movement like a lot of other a lot of other performing arts does, you can modify it endlessly and you can make it accessible to anyone at any level. And it's even being used in gym classes. It's kind of like this whole thing that's happening through the research world and then exploded into the school world in Canada. So like it's everywhere.
That's awesome. Circus is taking over the world.
Taking over the world. I know. Listen, you're like, give me like a 2-sentence answer. I'm like, here's my treatise on what is circus.
No, I love that. And I really do love your explanation of what all it can encompass, because I think hopefully people who are listening to this, if they are, whether they're performers, dance teachers, dance medicine and performing arts specialists, maybe realizing that some of the people that we're already working with, things that we're already doing, actually do belong and cross over into the circus world. And so when we're seeing like, oh, there's a presentation on circus arts or, you know, whatever, it's like, eh, that's not really my thing. I'm not going to go to that presentation. It's like, maybe you should, because you're probably going to learn some stuff that's going to help the performers you're working with.
Or these days, like as we were both talking about, there's this expansion of inclusion of circus into theater shows, dance shows. It's never out of the question that a dancer might be like, some directors can be like, well, you should just get up on an aerial hoop during that section. And that's just, you now have to learn this for the show and have these new challenges that now you may be hanging from your arms, and you might have a background in ballet. And those are very different demands on the body.
Mm-hmm. I'm even seeing with some of my kids that I work with at dance studios where it seems there's just this uptick of taking tumbling and acro classes and, you know, doing things where it's starting to move almost into some of the like contortion body movements and things like that, that they're incorporating just as a dancer at a studio down the street somewhere. And so understanding more of what all goes into that. Yeah.
That extreme range of motion that's been there for a while and now taking it more into like the tumbling realm too. It's a huge demand that may or may not have the background of education. Even the dance world, we have, you know, a very flexible pathway to become an instructor. The circus world is that and more, because you really can, there is no nationally or internationally recognized certification to become an instructor. And so how many people are teaching contortion? And it's so much more now than there were 5-10 years ago. Where are they all coming from? So the quality of education and knowledge about the body going into those shapes and those positions has a huge range as well.
Mm-hmm. What are some things that, let's see, I have multiple questions in my head of where I want to go. So let's see, first question. First question, what would you say are some of the maybe misconceptions about circus performers that providers might have if they're not familiar with working with these folks?
I think the biggest one is that they're all going to be 20 to 25 and buff and high-level professionals. The majority of these circus stars that I see in my clinic range in age from probably, you know, like mid-late teens, that's usually when they start seeing me instead of a pediatric therapist, mid-late teens through their 70s. They've been training anywhere from, you know, 6 months to 10 years. They are generally recreational artists that may do like a school performance. And that is the majority of who my clients are. I do also see professionals, absolutely, but that's not going to be for the majority of clinicians who's walking into their practice. It's going to be the person from the dance studio. It's going to be the person who picked up aerial silks and does it after their 9-to-5 job, which means you have the challenges of not having this professional athlete. You have a normal human trying to do extraordinary things, which is awesome and healthy and full range of motion and strength and love all this. But it's not someone that's been doing it since they were four, born into a circus family. So that's probably the biggest one. And then the other big misconception is trying to apply our normal standards without having that deeper thought process of why is this normal? So if you think about like with our dancers, same thing as our circus stars, hamstring length, right? Yeah. Normal hamstring length is not the range of motion that our artists generally need to get back to their activities. It needs to be a lot more. Okay, why is that normal? Is it normal because of the joint structure? Or is it normal because of tissue tension? Or is it normal because our normative data comes from a sedentary, mostly male population? Mm-hmm. Right? What are the structures that are underlying it? Is there actually a limiting factor there? Or is it just normal because of who we're measuring?
Yeah. And a lot of those standards that we have of what is normal, especially thinking joint ranges of motion and that sort of thing. I mean, these have been the norms for forever. I don't know when they were established, but a long time ago. And I don't know if they've been updated or, you know, categorized more or something like that. But I mean,
gotten more or less, who knows?
Right? Like, wouldn't that be interesting?
Have we become more sedentary and less mobile? Have we become, I don't have no idea.
New research ideas right here happening at the moment. Love it.
We're taking over the world.
Yes, like we said. Another question for you. So again, thinking of the providers who might be working with these performers, what would you say are some key questions to ask when first starting with them, or key things to understand when we're doing like an evaluation, for example?
Really great question. One of the things is to treat a circus artist like any other athlete, not an artist who can like, or that somebody who's doing it as a hobby, even though they are hobbyists. Think of them as like your crazy runners. They're also hobbyists, but you know, if you tell them not to run, they're going to go out and run. You have to tell them how to modify or how to, or work with them to figure out a plan that makes sense enough to them and they feel supported enough to follow it. This can be a little harder when we're talking about circus artists when you may not know what they're doing. So starting there, your first question you should ask if you have a circus artist is, what discipline or apparatus do you train on? Or do you train in? Do you train multiple? Many people will train multiple apparatus or multiple disciplines, but just asking that question opens the door to them to actually tell you a little bit about what's going on. What I hear from so many artists, which is really, really unfortunate, is that they actually hide that they do circus from their provider because they don't want their provider to say, stop doing that, because somebody already has once. Yeah. And so they're just like, I won't tell them. And then we don't get the full information. So if you ask them what discipline they do and you listen, and then if you want to say, stop doing that, take a second, collaborate with the patient. Okay, I'm really afraid about you hanging from your right wrist. Are there things you can do that don't involve doing that? Really explaining your thought process helps them have more autonomy that they can bring their knowledge of what they do in class, what they do during their day, to that process. It's going to make them trust you more as a provider, and it's going to get them better results because they're going to listen to you and stick to your plan.
Yes. I think that sort of story of, you know, whether it's not wanting to go see a provider in the first place or not opening up about what exactly it is you do as any sort of performing artist has been too common of a story that I hope is changing with, you know, with the internet and things like this, where we have an opportunity to say, yes, there are people who understand and want to help and that sort of thing. But, you know, it definitely has been a problem.
Yeah. It's like the thing that makes me like the saddest when somebody's like, oh, I just don't tell my provider. And I'm like, whoa, you're depriving your provider of a lot of information. So you're depriving yourself of a lot of information. And so the more welcome we can make them feel. So asking about their discipline, and then like any athlete, talking to them about their training regimen. They may not have a training plan. Training plans are not really common in circus. Helping to educate them on a training plan. But what is your training regimen? How many days a week are you training? 8? That's too many, right? Like any performing artist is like, I want to do it all the time. I identify as my discipline. I identify as dancer. I identify as aerialist. I identify as acrobat. Like they have such a strong identification with it. Asking about their training, asking them about nutrition, about sleep, about cross training and lack thereof, because all they do is their apparatus because they love it so much. Again, same with all our performing artists, but it's talking to them like an athlete, asking the questions you would ask any athlete, just replace the sport with their discipline.
Thinking about the performer now, mm-hmm. What would be maybe a piece of advice that you have for somebody, like if somebody's listening and they're like, oh, I guess I do kind of identify in this circus realm, whether or not I knew it. How would you recommend they look for somebody who understands what it is that they do, whether it's for physical therapy or some other sort of health or wellness provider?
Yeah. So the network of communities is really strong. So if they are a performer in their local area, talking to other performers, instructors, other students, finding out who they go to, because that means the provider is already speaking the language, at least a little bit. There's, of course, listings and resources on all the performing arts medicine websites. So like Performing Arts Medicine Association, International Association of Dance Medicine Science, all have listings. On my website, actually, I am in the process. I have about 75 providers up right now. So it's a small list, but it's growing. And these are people that have either trained with me or have just said, hey, I see a lot of circus artists in my area. I want to be a resource. And they get added to the list. And so you can see where they are in the world, what their specialties are, and really just that they're already reaching out and saying, hi, I'm here for you. But I would start by asking around in your community, because those are the folks who are going to know exactly what happens in your school, exactly what happens in your performance space. And that network is really strong. On the flip side of that, I would say providers, just treat your performers well and your clinic will always be full. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I know in some of our like traditional dance forms, say ballet, for example, there are certain things that I sometimes hear from my dancers, especially younger dancers, where, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they're having some aches or pains or things, but they think of them as like, well, everybody has this. So I don't really think about seeing somebody about it or bringing it up as a problem. My hip always pops, my feet always hurt from point. Things like that. Are there some examples like that that you see more commonly within circus arts and maybe particularly with maybe the more kind of common mainstream apparatus or disciplines?
Absolutely. So very similar to the dance world, like some discomfort is normal. And so a lot of schools, a lot of people have adopted the idea, and some like even emblazon it on their clothing and things like that, that circus hurts. So circus hurts is like a phrase that's out there, which as a circus artist, I love. Like, to be honest, like to be completely honest,
yeah,
I love it. I'm like, yeah, it does hurt, but you know what? You push and you go and you build and you grow from that. Like, and that's really powerful. But for our youth coming up, or what I like to call adult onset circus artists, mm-hmm. like who may or may not have had a background in movement or a background in exercise and may not be able to distinguish between delayed onset muscle soreness and injury. And that kind of language is really hard. Mm-hmm. And it's really confusing. So there's a little bit of that kind of barrier we need to work on.
Yeah.
Just like in the dance world, students coming through classes will go to the coach first. And so when they go to the coach and say, which is most common in the dance in the circus world, Ariel in particular, my shoulder hurts when I do that. The coach will also say, mine too. Let's try it again, right?
Yep.
Versus where, how, when, why, what type of pain, what are we talking about here? And like, yeah, like there may be stress or work, but is that what the student was actually talking about, you know? And even so, should that instructor's shoulder hurt too? Probably not.
Another discussion.
Another discussion. But there's so many layers there when we normalize pain versus yeah. appreciating a squeeze or pressure or the muscle's effort of growing, right? So similar to other performing arts, there's just that concept of what is pain, what is injury, how do we help performers understand that? And then specific to circus, the most common chronic injury, which is when people run into this problem more than like, I broke my ankle, very clear, yep. Is shoulder. This joint has a huge amount of range of motion. And as circus artists, whether we're hanging from it or standing on it, we're asking the shoulder to function in very, very end range under load. So hanging traction or loaded handstands, pushing load. especially our aerialists, hanging is just the start, right? You're in range, in end range, you're loaded in a traction way, and now you start moving your body, right? So you've got these muscles at this extreme length, trying to create tension and force, right? So that length tension relationship of muscles that they fire better in mid range. Throw that out the window, we're at end range. And now you're gonna lift your legs over your head. And so the shoulder just ends up getting such a huge amount of load as the small stabilizer muscles are fighting to stabilize it. And as the giant muscles that only get bigger as we get stronger are yanking on it to move our bodies around. So the shoulder is by far the biggest kind of chronic overuse injury that can turn into something more acute or cause long-term wear and tear as we go through their careers.
For people who are wanting to get into some of these disciplines, whether it is kids incorporating it in their dance studies, adults who go, ooh, that looks like fun, I want to try that. What are some pieces of advice that you have for them of like what to pay attention to, what to ask about, how to know that where they're going is a good place to start learning this?
Great question. First one is, do absolutely go to a circus school to learn circus. The internet, while you can learn some things, is not a great beginner learning environment. Especially if you're, I'm gonna go to aerial because that is where most of our schools are opening up in the US. It's probably 80, 90% of the schools that are opening are aerial schools. Ideally they've been around for a couple of years. That may not be possible in every environment. There aren't that many of them, but there are schools that have been safety certified by the American Youth Circus Organization, and they will have a safety seal on it. And you can get more information on that at the American Youth Circus Organization's website. Full disclosure, I'm on the board, but we are the only national circus organization in the US that is working on this education level. But the safety seal means they have their rigging practices checked. It means they are committed to mat usage practices and other things to keep their students safe. So though we have no certification process for trainers, that's official. There are different certification processes. I will talk about that in a second. This safety seal does say your rigging is solid at the school. The school itself as a building and as a learning environment is safe. Again, not that many schools have it. But it is something if you have one in your community, that's like, yes, absolutely. The school has been investing in their long-term development. And hey, if you ask about it, maybe they'll do it because it's a great way to make sure that we're safer. There are certification, teacher certifications, though they range in quality. And again, anyone can be a teacher's teacher kind of thing. Having someone who's taken any of them versus none of them is going to be a better sign that you can say, hey, do you have any certifications to teach? Or have you taken any programming? Because really certification is a sheet of paper, but have you done any trainings to support your teaching, or you just learned on yourself and then now teaching me? So again, though, that may not exist in your community. So we've got all these kind of layers where I'm like, you know, gold standard, silver standard. Next would be, go there, set up a time to walk in. And if they don't want you to do that, that's kind of like icky, kind of like a, you know, you don't want to just go. You could sign up for a dance class if you know the school and show up and whatever, especially if you have kids involved. Go there, observe a little bit. If it's aerial, look at the rigging. If you have no idea what you're looking at, if it looks funky, it probably is. Let's just go with that. Doesn't matter if you have an untrained eye. If you have no idea what you're looking at, just ask questions like, hey, did you have a professional rigger install this, or did you do it yourself? Right? Mm-hmm. Just because they did it themselves, again, doesn't mean it's not good. It's just one of those things. They should have an answer for you. You know, I did it myself. I have a lot of rigging background. You know, they should be able to answer your questions and answer your questions without being defensive. And that's just kind of just, you know, I would say the same thing for a physical therapist. Come in, ask us questions. If the person gets defensive, probably a bad sign.
Right. Most definitely. What are, so we talked about shoulder being a big area of injury for circus artists. What are some other common types of injuries that you maybe see a little more frequently?
Yep. So shoulder is by far the biggest one. And there can be lots of different pain areas, often impingement due to multiple different reasons. Like, is the shoulder blade moving well? Is the arm moving well? Do they move well together? Do they not move well around the rib cage? Lots of things going on there. Proximal hamstring. So that hamstring area, right where your hamstring meets the booty, kind of similar to our dancers as well. That is probably maybe the next most common. Also one that people don't seek treatment for unless they know that there's somebody to go to, because they're like, oh, I'll just stretch it. It feels really tight. And then 3 years later, they're like, why does my hamstring still hurt?
Mm-hmm.
If you're a performer out there with a proximal hamstring injury up by your butt and it's not getting better, go get care. We can help you. We have a lot of knowledge to help you with that. And I know it just feels like a tight hamstring, but it's not. If it's been lasting more than a week or two, like, yeah, even if you come in for one visit, we can give you so many tools. Big believer in physical therapy. So those are probably the two most common. For my aerialists, elbow pain from gripping, and the fact that our muscles develop faster than our tendons. So those we get really excited. We're learning a new skill, or we start training, going from one day a week to like 6 days a week of training. Those tendons aren't quite as ready to respond. And so we get a lot of what we call epicondylalgia, can't talk today, epicondylalgia, pain in the elbows, pain in your elbow bones, or for lots of different reasons. Again, but it's usually that tendinous attachment is cranky because the muscle's been yanking on it and the tendon's like, I have not grown up yet.
Mm-hmm.
Take care of me.
I am not prepared.
So that's really common in my aerialists, especially on vertical apparatus. So if you've seen the aerial silks or aerial fabric, which again, one of the most common because of that ulnar deviated grip. So if you're watching this on video, you're seeing me do this with my hand. But if you grab and turn your hand towards your pinky, that grip just really loads that inside elbow. And so I do see that even more prevalently in that community. In our ground acrobats and tumblers, it's ankles. Ankle sprains from landing short or landing with a twist a little off, or let's be real, falling off mats.
Yep.
Danger. Big danger in the circus studio. Feet between mats, feet off the edges of mats. You should just not use mats. Don't use that as a soundbite.
Use mats, please.
Use mats. The injuries you get, even if you trip on a mat, is less than the injury you would get if you didn't have a mat. Please use mats.
Yes.
Oh, and that actually brings me to another one, concussions. It's but concussions are actually a big deal, either through whiplash or through impact. So I'm big on, especially adult concussion care can be a big thing in circus as well.
And I think that's something that we often forget about when we start getting into the performing arts side. It's like, oh yeah, I'm going to see lots of ankles and knees and, you know, whatever, that kind of stuff. But concussion definitely is a big one. And I think it's one too that the performers themselves sometimes aren't aware that it's as big of a problem, or, you know, because it's not a big hit like in football where we hear about a lot of stuff, or, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, I got dropped in a lift and I hit my head and, you know, things were awful for a little while, but I was fine. Yeah, I've definitely heard that from.
Yeah, they're not able to make that judgment. They're the one who just bonked their head. But two, we don't talk about concussions in not kids. We don't talk about concussions in our performing arts. They may not even realize they have a concussion or know to get care. One of the things that I do in my community is with one of my staff members who, let's be real, I'm not great at concussion care. I have people who are better at it. But with one of my staff members, you know, we go around and we're like, hey, instructors, here are your red flags and yellow flags. Like, let's talk about what to do. And we do like a little like first aid, like what, when to call, who to call type thing for everything. But concussion is like probably the one they actually use the most.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a city. So like somebody breaks their leg, they're going to call 911. The fire department is there in like under 2 minutes, like so close to our major circus schools. They don't have to deal with that. Concussion, they have to deal with the human and inform them and educate them in a really different way.
Mm-hmm. Switching gears a little bit, let's talk about you as the author now. Talk to us a little bit about what you have out there that is available.
Yeah. So it's so funny because you say that and it's, you go through your lifetime and the longer you've been around, you have to remember what you've done, which is kind of incredible. And I am honored and humbled to kind of be able to have that moment. But the biggest thing, the reason I think of myself as author is I did write a book. So I wrote a book called Applied Anatomy of Aerial Arts, which came out in 2018. It is the first and only anatomy book for aerial arts. It was published in 2018. There are illustrations of muscles and kind of goes through general anatomy and biomechanics for the standard shapes like straight arm hanging, so arms overhead and hanging, all the way through all the different aerial skills that are kind of fundamental, what muscles are working and where, and then some exercises is the same thing, like why these are important and kind of breaking down the skills in a really biomechanical way. So I wrote that. That was a big undertaking. I'm like, still wasn't sure. I think I knew what I got myself into when I said I was going to do it. but did write that. And then more recently, I wrote with other authors. I was lead author on two of the three manuscripts for the independent study course for the American Physical Therapy Association on circus artists. So we have an independent study course that's out there. There were 1, 2, 3, 4 of us working on. And so that's also a resource out there for clinicians or really anyone to read more about what it's like working with circus artists. So those are probably my two biggest projects. I've done a little bit of other writing here and there when people have asked me to write articles for different magazines and events and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so good to know that those sorts of resources exist both for the clinician, if instructors want to learn more, whatever, that there are good, reliable sources out there to go to. And it's not just the internet search and hoping, I found some article on, I don't know what site that tells me about these things.
Yeah, you at least know where it's come from and that it's mm-hmm. been vetted by somebody.
Mm-hmm. Then you as researcher, what are some things that, let's see, I'm going to backpedal here for a second.
Yeah.
What's maybe something that as you've gotten into the research side of things that maybe you were either sort of pleasantly surprised, like, oh yeah, the research demonstrates this, or going, ooh, I learned something new from this research study that I was involved in.
Yeah. So the first thing that you learn when you come out of school as an idealist, when you come out of school, all bright-eyed, bushy-tailed and idealistic, and you're like, nobody knows anything about circus, I want to research it, is that to study humans, you have to go through an IRB process. And that is absolutely prohibitive as a clinician, for the most part, unless you're able to partner with the university. So I didn't get to flex my research muscles very much until relatively recently. So this is a new part of my life as I've forged forged relationships with universities in my community, as some of my colleagues and peers are hitting the point of getting tenure at their universities and have a little more flexibility in their research, or as circus research in general has grown, because now that's a field that didn't exist 5 years ago or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's relatively newer to me. I have assisted in some research projects. So there was a big multi-site study looking at injury rates over the course of a year at 10 different sites around the US. I was a Seattle-based PT, and that was my big participation in that research. And through that research, that is starting to really come out now, what surprised me was so far, at least from the data we collected, which ended up being from the 10 sites, I believe it was 170 or 180 participants. So a lot of humans. Mm-hmm. So glad I wasn't in charge of that research study. But what they found was that range of motion and strength weren't correlated with injury risk. We kind of thought we were going to find that people who were more mobile or really, really immobile would have higher injury risks, or that people who were weaker would have higher injury risks, and that just wasn't statistically there. So we were surprised. And that, you know, who knows what's going to happen as more research comes out. This was the first kind of thing of that size. Most of the research is coming from circus schools. By schools, I mean like vocational schools where they are training to be circus artists, mm-hmm. of which we have one in the US, and there's two in Canada. So from like those schools, they have done research on those students, or companies like Cirque du Soleil that have funding to study their artists because they want to keep them healthy to continue to make money as an organization. So this is the first kind of study that's more like the people that are going to walk into my clinic, you know, the professional artists that are local in the community, the pre-professionals that are performing one or two times a year and kind of playing with it. So it was interesting. That was like my biggest like, oh, that's not what I expected. And we'll see kind of what comes of that. And then the other research I've been a part of right now, we are in the process. We actually just submitted to a journal the write-up of our public survey on pelvic floor issues in circus artists. And the biggest aha takeaway, I mean, other than pelvic floor issues are incredibly common and are in our circus artists as well. So this is something definitely we should kind of keep our eyes on, and we're going to do further research on. But we tried really hard to survey circus artists. Mm-hmm. And from the start of our conversation, you know, that is a massive group, and to get them all to buy in to take a survey is hard. So we sent out things to circus artists. We had about 500 responses, which is incredible. 450 or so of them were female aerialists. So it pulls back to telling us, like, who are the people in our community? It's in the US, we skew female. In the US, we skew aerial. That is not necessarily true in other countries, but it's all of our researchers were US based. So it did definitely skew our research too. So it's like, mm-hmm. yeah. But friends of mine, like the study by Stephanie Greenspan that I was a part of, when they go to get published and they're like, you have too many women, why don't you have any more males? And it's like, because that's what we're dealing with in the US. That's where we are.
Yeah.
Dealing with the problem. That's how great women are empowered to move their bodies and learn new skills are in the US.
Yes. Going back to those of us who are clinicians working with circus artists, if we are not sort of dedicated within that niche, what are some things that we should consider having in the clinic as far as tools or things like that to at least like bare minimum have?
Yeah, great question. Something to hang on. A phone with a camera or a video tool. Heavy things to lift. Like, that's it. You can do it today. Like, there's not a big barrier. Most people have pain or have issues with something that's relatively fundamental. It's not like I only have issues when I put my big toe in my ear. There's usually like, folks that come in to see me, probably 70% of them mostly or only, when they come in, say they mostly or only have pain doing circus. So they may be fine in their daily life, but circus, oh, but I have pain when I put my arms over my head. Great. So when you're reaching up to a shelf and putting a glass away, that might not tip it off, but just that little bit more, which means you can assess that in the clinic. You can have them just do a full range shoulder flexion. Ideally, you have them hang. If they are a vertical artist, sometimes you can just throw a towel or a really heavy TheraBand over a pull-up bar and have somebody to grip and to look at how they're hanging or gripping in that environment. I say a camera because, and that could be your patient's camera, which is really helpful. It's even more important than a mirror. They can look at their back and they can see how things are moving. You can show them things because they're movement artists who are used to communicating about and talking about movement. If you communicate with them in a way that's discussing their movement versus only talking about structure, they're going to get it. So if you can show them how their body moves differently with XYZ and then give that to them on their camera and send it home with them, it can be incredibly powerful. And then I say heavy things because they may be lifting another person and a, you know, 5 pound weight isn't going to do it. You need to be able to actually load them and load them appropriately to get them back. I will also say one of the complaints I get from my professional artists is I went to see a clinician and they said, wow, you're so strong. And essentially, I don't know what to do with you.
Yes.
They're there for a reason. So help them, ask them questions, try to dive into where and when their pain happens. There's a reason they're there. And also just as a reminder to clinicians, our words matter so much. The more dedicated our artists are to their craft and to their bodies, the more everything we say about their bodies is something they will take with them for a long time. And so really trying to keep the positive affect and the empowering language and the confidence in the body that I hope we all have, that the body is capable of healing. And to help our patients remember that and just be the people that are giving the body the tools or giving the patient the tool to allow their body to do that healing. So keep it optimistic.
Yes. 100%.
So I guess think, optimism is the other piece that I want clinicians to bring.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the words that we use, the way that we interact with our clients is really important. Like you said, not just going, well, you're really strong. I don't know what to do with you now. Or, you know, thinking of some of the dancers that I work with and people who are any sort of like a flexible athlete, just because they have really great range of motion to achieve a position or a movement doesn't necessarily mean that the best muscles are being used most effectively, that the range is coming from where you think it's coming from. You know, there are a lot of things that can kind of break down within there that you can start to dive into. So even though just from a distance, it's like, well, I think that looks pretty good, but you're saying you have pain. There's a lot to check to kind of verify within that.
Yeah. One of my mentors, Shirley Starman, she always says, are you wearing that muscle or are you using it? You know? So for my artists, I'm like, you are really strong. You are really, really good at learning movement. What I'm seeing is that you're just not moving those muscles at the right time in the right pattern. But because you're really great at learning movement, this is something that is absolutely, we can change and we can make your pain get better, right? It's taking that same thing. You are strong. You are powerful. You have skills. Let's use them. So it's not just saying you're strong. I don't know what to do with you. It's saying you're strong. Let's use that to our advantage in your rehab.
Mm-hmm. Again, my brain is going in like 5 different places because I have so many different thoughts going on, especially once you mentioned Shirley Sarman. Love Shirley Sarman. Have been blessed to have been able to be at several of her talks and things like that over the years. And I love every single one of them.
I've just never seen somebody. I've had the pleasure of being in the clinic with her. And I say pleasure because it is amazing to watch a patient come in. I swear, all she does is laugh at them, make fun of them. They come back 3 weeks later and they're pain-free. And I'm like, what just happened?
Right.
But if you ever heard Shirley laugh, you'll understand.
There are videos available online from some of her talks, and she always throws jokes in there. So I can pretty much guarantee if you find a video of her, you probably will get to hear her laugh in there somewhere.
Yeah. She just laughs at the patient and they get better. I'm like, this is the provider I want to be. This is it.
Mm-hmm. It's magical.
It's magic.
I think another thing that kind of came to mind as we were talking there about just our words and how we're interacting with our clients and that sort of thing is even if someone comes in and, you know, I'm not a circus specialist, but knowing some of the basic questions to ask admit that, like, I am not familiar with this apparatus that you're talking about. Tell me more about it. Like, I want to learn from you and not just be like, well, I don't know how to help you, or go, oh yeah, I totally know what this is, even though I definitely don't.
No, you know what performers like doing the most? Talking about themselves and the things they love to do. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know. That's actually kind of cool for the patient. They get to explain and talk about it. And probably unlike our dancers, circus artists are videoing every training session, or a lot of them are. So they have a video of that skill they hurt themselves on. And if they don't have a video of that skill that they hurt themselves on, they have a video of somebody else doing it that they've saved in their Instagram feed. You know, if they, they will show you. They will happily show you. And I know that it's, you know, I always feel like it's a little unfair because some of our clinicians are just so overburdened and overworked and don't have the time to do that, which mm-hmm. is fair. But sometimes it's, you will get through your treatment faster if you take a moment and say, I'm not exactly sure what you mean. Can you tell me? Can you tell me more about that? It seems like it's going to take more time, but I promise you it will end up saving you time. And using your great interviewing skills with your patients, you can navigate that conversation.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things is getting to see my performers do their thing. So whether I go see one of their shows or competitions, or have them send me a video, or, you know, whatever. Yeah, I love sitting there and watching it. And I'm usually, like, especially if I'm watching it just like at home or in my office, just on my own time or something like that, or I'm sitting in an audience somewhere where they don't know where I am and who I am out there, I am just like, yes, that was amazing. You know, it's the biggest cheerleader.
Yeah, I totally knew like where you were going with that. I was like, yeah, if I'm sitting at home and watching it, like a video, I'm like, yeah, yeah, look at that knee hook. Yeah, I get so excited.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or watching some of my dancers, like one of my dancers' mom sent me a video of her recently from a competition, and it was a hip hop number, and she's just like getting into it, and I'm sitting here watching it. I'm like, yeah, that was awesome, you know, like joining her on stage, basically.
Excellent.
So yes, please share, because we want to know. We want to see these things.
We do. We do. And if your clinician doesn't, if your clinician doesn't want to know and they don't ask you questions, ideally you're in a position to find a different clinician. It doesn't mean they have to know dance. It doesn't mean they have to know circus, but it does mean they have to be interested and engaged in your care. Yes. And I just want to empower performers out there to find good care. I know it's a pain in the butt. I know it's an extra burden that you don't want or need, but I also know that your care is important to you. So if you don't feel like you can have those conversations, if you don't feel like your clinician is your true cheerleader, see if you can switch.
Mm-hmm. There are probably options. At this point, I think it's a good opportunity to go to a special segment on the show, and I made this just for you. So we always have the final bow, but I was compelled to find an option that highlighted some sort of aerial or some circus discipline in there instead of my typical, like, here's ballet, here's hip hop, some of the different things. Now we have circus represented in my deck of options for the final bow.
Thank you so much. I feel so honored to be here today.
So the final bow is your take-home message for the audience. We've talked about a lot of different topics. We have a lot of different folks who listen to this, but what is one thing that you hope somebody walks away with having listened to this episode?
Oh my gosh. Can I do two? One is yes. So hard. Okay. My two things. I do want every clinician out there to realize that if you don't think you're seeing circus patients, either you are or you're about to. It is absolutely exploding. Take the time to get to know them. It is so much fun and so rewarding to collaborate on the care with these amazing artists. And my second one is, I truly believe the best way to work with any patient, but especially our performing artists, is through optimism and empowerment. And I really think that is a great message for all of us. And I'm going to take it for myself going through the rest of the day too. So that I think is just the biggest thing that I talk about when I'm working with other clinicians and doing education is how do we make that artist feel like they're going to heal and they're going to get better and they're going to be better than before and it's going to be amazing.
Yes. Finally, the shameless plug. This is your opportunity to plug anything that you have going on that you think the people need to know about or ways to find you.
I will not have shame about this because I believe that this is an amazing opportunity.
Please.
No, I'm really excited. I do offer continuing education courses for clinicians so that we can improve the knowledge around what it's like to work with circus artists, to have some of those questions alleviated of what are these basic fundamentals? How do I break them down? How do I help the artists build themselves back up? What are those common injuries? What does the literature say? So I do run a continuing education course online. I do also occasionally do in person, but the online course is a really great, great way to go. It is called Circus Fusion. It is 4 months long, though there is an extended version if you really want to get deep into it. And it is a really great opportunity to get to know this amazing population a little bit better.
Awesome. I'll make sure that when I post everything, there are links to you so that they can find all your stuff that's going on in all the different places. So thank you so much for your time today, Emily. It was a pleasure getting to chat with you.
Thank you so much for the awesome questions, taking us all over the map. It was a lot of fun.
Dance Med Spotlight is hosted and produced by Alyssa Arms. We discuss all things dance medicine. This has been another episode from Dance Med Spotlight. The Dance Med Spotlight is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present.